First, I think I should make a somewhat common apology today. I haven't talked about some of these things before, and so it will be a little disorganized maybe, and at least it could be done better. I'll start off with a somewhat serious joke. A new anthropic feature of our world. So, of course, we live in a string vacuum and we all live in the same one. And if that's not clear, that's a different talk, but I'll say some things about it. If we didn't get TEV scale data, then it would be essentially impossible to learn more about the string vacuum we live in and untangle the underlying theory. The TEV scale and the things that determine much of the features come from compactification and supersymmetry breaking and such features when after starting with a full string theory. And the data will tell us about those, and it'll tell us how the ground state that we live in emerges. But we're just at the limit of the technology and the funding and the society's ability to deal with these things.
So doesn't this suggest we should live in a vacuum where the laws of electromagnetism allow electricity to be cheaper?
Yeah, we should do something about that. Right, so if you think about it, there's a lot we could try and do. But we're sort of stuck in this vacuum as far as we know, at least for a while. And it's really quite lucky and somewhat amazing that we can study it. We are not going to get better machines or machines in the future that can teach us new things much beyond it. So remarkably, we might be able to get enough understanding from LHC and a few associated experiments to actually untangle all of this. And we have hope of really making sense. But without, it's just at the right edge of being able to do it. So what do we want to understand about our string vacuum? This is a list that, of course, not everyone will exactly agree on what's on such a list, but this is my list of what I want to understand about our string vacuum. This is sort of a technical list, so not all of you will know what all these items are. The hierarchy between the weak scale and the Planck scale, the famous hierarchy problem, is in one sense the most important one. The most important one of all is one you won't, most of you won't recognize. It's the question of why the Z boson mass is so small. And the reason, I won't go into technical detail, but for people coming from my side of the approach, it's the most challenging thing, because we're trying to explain the Z boson mass and electroweak scale mass in terms of physics beyond the standard model. And so whatever physics it is that explains it has to give a mass, a thing with which we've never calculated from first principles before. And this is actually a very small mass, because experimental constraints and typical values for other masses tend to make them close to a TeV, close to 10 times this. And in fact, the natural thing to calculate is the square of it, if you look at real theories. So this is already 1 to 2 orders of magnitude smaller than we have any reasonable hope of explaining in a simple way, yet we want to explain it. So that's actually the major one from my point of view, but I won't say more about that directly. We want to know if the world is supersymmetric, if that's what explains the hierarchy, and then if it's broken. There's, well, I'll let you, or you've already read it, I'll come back to this list once more later, but these are the things that need explaining. I don't care if I can calculate the value of the electron mass or, you know.
So since you have said Z, why do you care about the Z as opposed to the W?
Same question.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just an example, right.
Right.
Right. Or the Higgs web, if you prefer. They're all the same question. Basically.
Isn't that in the Higgs, it's because of the radiative corrections that would normally give it a gut scale, isn't it? Is that same thing for the...
Not the same question. No, let's assume that you've stabilized the hierarchy and you've done fine. There's no more problem with radiative corrections, but you still haven't understood this mass or been able to calculate it from first principles.
Right.
And it's old physics, it's standard model physics. the explanation, if you can understand the numerical value of it and explain it, then it must come from new physics. And we already know that the new physics is not on quite the same scale, and we already know there's no simple way to do this. So it's really challenging.
So, sort of, why the choice to phrase it in this way as opposed to the Higgs bet, which I think would be a much more straightforward way to phrase it?
Oh, no, it depends on the audience. I for most audiences, I think the Z mass is something in particle physics they know well. They think they understand it in some sense, although they don't. The Higgs BEV already gets into some mysteries about where does the BEV come from and so forth. In the standard model, they're equivalent statements, but most of the time, I think it's a communication issue. That's all. Okay, so these kinds of things have not particularly led to multiverse ideas so far, but we know that there are three things that have. One is the many solutions of string theory that clearly exist. One is eternal inflation. You can add things to this list that you want. For most particle physicists, these two things, plus the fact that there's no explanation yet why the cosmological constant is so small, have led many of us, or maybe it's not many yet, but a lot of us, to take very seriously multiverse kinds of ideas and treat them. They're clearly science, and we want to think about them that way. So I'm not coming from a top-down approach or a fundamental cosmology approach. I want to know what these things have to do with the string vacuum I live in and what they have to do with the questions on that list that I just wrote. So there are at least two related perspectives I can take. First, they seem to be a little orthogonal. For example, if you look at the type 2D string calculations with flux vacua that have led to the famous 10 to the 500 vacua and such things, and look, those are counting of different kinds of vacua in a certain way, and there's no particular reason to think any of those 10 to 500 have standard model physics in them. Maybe some do. But it looks like all that kind of issue is more or less orthogonal to the kinds of questions I'm raising here. But what I found is that in constructing a particular vacuum that I'm going to tell you about, that and you can see clearly when you construct any particular string depth, there's no way you will get a small cosmological constant in a particular string depth. It simply doesn't happen. You calculate what the scalar potential of theory, the potential energy of all the scalars, and you look for the minimum where they sit. And in fact, to make sense of the theory and do calculations, you have to tune the value of the minimum to be small, so you don't interfere with predictions. And it can be crucial for some predictions to do that, but you can only do that tuning if you have enough vacua to do it in a sensible way. And that seems to be leading us to testable predictions about things like dark matter and LHC signatures, and I'll show you a couple of those. So most of the rest of the talk, I will soon go to pursuing that second point. I'll take as an example work we've done where we directly take M theory in 11 dimensions, compactify on a manifold with G2 holonomy that has 7 dimensions, that leaves 4 that we live in. And I'll illustrate how that tuning may work and the kinds of predictions it leads to and how it addresses a number of those questions. This is an example of a case where it's suggestive that something may happen like this. There are a lot of people today trying to construct these string vacua and look at predictions in various ways. And there's a lot of progress in this kind of thing. So I'll focus on that for the next part of the talk. Then I'll say a little bit about these kinds of questions about how much we hope we can calculate, and at the end, superimposing some vacua to propose one kind of approach to suggest there can be approaches maybe to why the cosmological constant isn't large. So now I'm going to start talking more or less technically about this M theory compactification. I'll try and explain some of it, but it's unavoidably somewhat technical, but I think even if you don't know much about the stuff, you'll get the idea of what I'm doing. Oops. So it's work, there are 4 papers that we've written over 2 years Three of them extremely long, so I can't, even a short, even a summary, can't cover all of it. But in this paper, we've showed how we can use supersymmetry breaking at the high scale with Gugino condensation. It stabilizes all of the relevant moduli for us, minimizes the scalar potential. We get, in fact, a unique De Sitter minimum of the potential is metastable. A TEV scale emerges from the Planck scale input, and we get various things that I'll mention, including we can calculate the relic density of dark matter, and we know what the dark matter is like in this approach. And we've shown that it doesn't have lots and lots of problems it could have. We're currently studying or writing papers on several more things. And the two things that haven't yet been covered well are a proper embedding of the standard model matter, I'll mention that in a minute, and a detailed theory of the inflation. But lots of the rest of the issues, including maybe the strong CP calculation and so on.
I just have a couple of questions to get oriented on your approach. So you're saying the TV scale emerging, is that just in the standard way, the gauge coupling unification?
No. You start in the 11-dimensional theory at the Planck scale, and you do some calculations and ask where the particles are, and they come out at the TEV scale.
Sorry, so what's setting that scale in the theory?
The Planck scale. You mean why does it come out TEV?
Yeah.
Well, I'll mention it a little bit in context, but the Gugino condensation makes that happen in more or less the old-fashioned way. It's not a new thing, but here we're doing it in a way that So if you use Gugino condensation up to the high scale, then the condensing occurs at 10 to the 13 or 14 GeV, say. And the superpotentials, the ratio basically of that to the Planck scale cubed suppression because of the dimensions of the superpotential. So that accounts for almost all the effect.
Okay.
And we have, but we do it not just with hand waving, but quantitatively.
Okay. And is your low energy species a minimal flavor violating, or how does it deal with this flavor problem?
Let me come a little bit to that, but we have no flavor problems in this approach. Now, there's been a fair amount of, not a lot, a fair amount of earlier work on this, mostly papers by Witten and by Acharya and collaborators. And what they talked about was embedding the matter in G2 manifolds, embedding the standard model for grand unified matter in G2 manifolds. But there is no derivation of that embedding yet. They basically make a local embedding, and it's basically a consistency or accommodation argument that they've done. No one has yet done a proper embedding, and we've started to work on that issue. And they address things like proton decay and double triplet splitting and so forth. Gauge coupling unification can occur naturally in this scheme. So I'm not going to discuss these papers. I'm going to go on to the part we wanted to do the moduli stabilizing first, because then we can trust calculations of superpartner masses and even gauge couplings and W masses, things that depend on the moduli, and see how the supersymmetry breaking and the moduli are connected. So we generate the electro weak scale, as I said. It's a unique metastable De Sitter vacuum. We understand how that occurs. We start off with a large number of anti-De Sitter vacua, and then include matter at singularities and calculate F turns, and we end up with this structure. It's very important that we do this in a fluxless vacuum. In fact, the reason we started to work on this stuff is because all the calculations based on that stabilizing moduli with fluxes seem to have a problem getting a TEV scale out, and we didn't like that or see how to deal with it in a non-tuned way. And Acharya had worked on these vacua and knew that a fluxless stabilization could occur. So we started talking, in fact, at a meeting at Perimeter about 2.5 years ago on string phenomenology. He and I made the connection that led to this work. Yeah, so Perimeter contributed in an important way. The results then fit a lot of that are consistent with a lot of things you would like. And the only dimensionful input is the Planck scale, and the rest is coming out. And we're assuming that the work on the matter can fit in, and we're working on that, as I said. I won't say much about the stringy stuff. It's known that if you have a space that you two hole in only, it preserves an equal one supersymmetry in four dimensions. I mentioned that. Not abelian gauge fields occur in three cycles where there's an orbital fold singularity, and chiral fermions at three folds where there's a conical singularity. And in general, we have only gravity mediated supersymmetry breaking because we're embedding two three-dimensional submanifolds in a seven-dimensional space. So just generically, they won't interact with each other otherwise. People have written down, again, not very the most general form or the most easy form of things like Kaelic potentials to calculate a full set of observables. You need to write down the superpotential and the gauge kinetic function and the Kaelic potential. Those are, if you don't know what they are, just treat them as three things you have to write. You can define the volume of the cycles as a product of the moduli to some powers AI, where the AI are rational numbers, and they're the sum of them is 7/3, where 7 is the 7 of G of the G2 manifold, and the 3 is the 3 cycle 3. So those are not accidents, and it would be different in a different compactification. And this is a constraint, and there are many, many ways of fulfilling this. We stabilize these values and get some modulus, some volume, and then we can use a Kaelic potential from there.
Excuse me, before you go on, so this is a class of seven-dimensional manifolds which have G2 holonomy. Are you working in the general manifold in that class, or a particular one, a particular set?
It's general in the sense that I wish it were more particular, but not enough is known about G2 manifolds to completely calculate a set of parameters or numbers or things which specify a given manifold, except locally. So the A's and the I'm about to write the gauge kinetic function, which depends on some integer coefficients, and the
So I guess my question is, in this class of manifolds, how many discrete numbers are there and how many continuous parameters?
No continuous parameters, and the number of discrete ones is a counting that hasn't actually been worked out yet. And it's interesting, it's a very huge number, and we don't know, it's another of the things we're working on.
So there's no, if you say there's no continuous parameters, so there's nothing, I mean, like the Schwarzschild solution has a mass and the de Sitter.
You specify those rational numbers A, and you specify a gauge kinetic function which goes into the superpotential in the sum of terms like this that are non-perturbative, and I'll write the gauge kinetic function in the next slide. And you have some gauge groups that are going to condense, and the B's are basically the ranks or the dual Coxeter numbers of those gauge groups.
I think what you're saying in the language that Lee wants to be speaking is there are continuous parameters, but you get a potential for them which you minimize.
Oh, yes, the moduli. Yes, yes, of course. Sorry.
So I get a sense for how
in the string sense, in the string sense, you specify these things, but the moduli themselves that we're going to stabilize, I'll show you the potential in a minute, they all get stabilized at definite calculable values.
Right. But what is the dimension of the moduli space?
Again, no one knows exactly, but it can't be bigger than about 100 without getting contradictions, and it can't be littler than about 10 without, or you can count at least 10 to 15. So it's somewhere in that range. And what we do most of our calculations for a number n of moduli and then examine what happens with that.
Okay, so there's a number n of order 100 of moduli.
So it's 50 to 100.
That specifies, and there are a set of topological, of discrete topological invariants, of which there's about 100, which specify things like Betty numbers, three cycles, things
it's
like
just
that.
It's just three cycles, isn't it?
It's three cycles, yeah.
Three cycles, okay.
It's quite different from Clavielle, which is perhaps helpful, but not always.
Okay, so you're starting in a large parameter space, and the claim is that M theory yields a unique potential energy for these moduli.
No, for a given set of these A's and N's that I'll show you and so forth, then you get a unique potential.
And how do you calculate that?
I'll show you.
Okay.
This is a related question. The MSSM, you double the number of particles, and you have about 120 parameters.
No, we have no parameters. If you have an unbroken supersymmetry, you have no parameters whatsoever, right? The supersymmetry completely fixes the Lagrangian. So if you break the supersymmetry and, you look at the low-scale effective theory but don't know how you broke it, then you can have that many parameters if you have no relations among them. But if you know how you broke it, then you calculate all of it, which is what we're doing.
So do you know how to break it?
Well, we're breaking it by the Yagino condensation, which depends on one or two parameters. And so we'll calculate all the masses. I'll show you all the superpartner masses calculated to sort of a number plus or minus 30% on that. Yeah. The superpotential is then a general sum of terms that are exponential in the gauge kinetic function with coefficients that come from the hidden sector gauge groups. We do some work where we take a fairly large number of terms and sum numerically, but it's really helpful to be able to do semi-analytic work. If we took one term, it would stabilize all of the moduli that are in the gauge kinetic function because it's a non-perturbative contribution to the potential. But it turns out that you can't always guarantee the supergravity approximations to work if you take one. So we take two terms for a lot of semi-analytic work, and I'll show you formulas that have those two terms, and that works pretty well. And we can learn a huge amount by being able to do that. And then we check a lot of statements by taking more terms numerically.
Okay, and you said in the AK are constants which are in principle computable as a function of what?
The AK are computable if you knew all those stringy parameters, and they also depend on
the stringy parameters
those little AIs that I showed you and the Ns that are in the next slide I didn't get to yet. And in fact, let me go on a bit and see if you don't get a lot of these questions answered. Maybe not, but let's see what happens. The superpotentials and some, the AI are simply coefficients, but if you knew in detail the string theory, they're computable. They're numbers of qualitatively of order 1, but they could be 10, that kind of number. I'll illustrate later that for one case in Witten's papers, he computed the threshold corrections to the to two of the A's in a theory in detail.
Are these computed in first principles from string theory or M theory? Do they depend on the particular details of the compactification you're expanding?
No, of course they depend on the compactification. That's what we want.
So therefore, in a certain sense, they're computable given an assumption of a compactification, but there's a very large dimensional space with many discrete and continuous parameters that determines what the compactification is.
The continuous ones are all stabilized. They're the moduli.
And the discrete ones?
The discrete ones we don't know, and we scan over them when we make predictions for experiments.
Scan over them means question is, so these discrete parameters, which are the topology of the compactified semi.
I think if I go on, you'll understand much better a lot of this. So why don't you wait and let me see what happens? So I'm just sort of telling you what we did here. I'm trying to summarize it. The gauge kinetic functions in general have been written down, and for M theory, they're linear combinations of the moduli. The Z's are the complex moduli whose real parts are the S's that were in the volume, and whose imaginary parts are axions that relate to the strong CP problem and things like that. And so there's this set of microscopic constants, the A's, the B's, these coefficients AK, which in general are discrete too, and these integers, positive integers, which are determined for a given G2 manifold, but are not yet, it's not yet known how to do that because simply not enough is known about these. So we, fortunately, most of the things we want to predict, but not all, we can scan over these and get interesting results. These do not depend on the moduli. So that makes the calculations much better. In addition, for the semi-analytic ones, we'll make one more simplification, which actually isn't too much of a one. We take the two hidden sector gauge kinetic functions equal, But that's true as long as the three cycles are in the same homology class. So there's a very large class of theories with that.
So the hidden sector group is itself a product group?
It doesn't matter. We take two or three cycles each with their own gauge group, then it doesn't have to be a product group, but we've looked at a couple numerical cases.
I'm not sure what you mean. If you've got each one has their own gauge group, then the whole thing is a product group.
Yes, well, the whole thing is, yes. Yes, yes, yes. Right. Okay. In addition, generically, there will be conical singularities in three cycles, and those give you chiral fermions, and so we have to include that as well in general, and there's a literature on how to do that, where you modify the superpotential in this way, and you get an effective meson condensate of these guys, so we include those. We do that, I will only show you results where we take one case, but we have considered taking several flavors in a given three cycle, or putting them in several three cycles, and all the qualitative results I give you come out the same for doing that. We've looked numerically at several choices like that to make sure it's not an artifact of some oversimplification. So then you do a lot of work and you get a scalar potential in the supergravity standard way. And that scalar potential depends on all of the moduli and all of the scalar of the chiral condensates. And it looks like this, and you minimize that, and you can do it for this for the semi-analytic case analytically, and what you find is that the moduli are stabilized at a value which depends on those integers n and those powers a and a function nu, and the p and q in here are the ranks of the two gauge groups that we're using.
The hidden sector quarks you just introduced. In the field theory approximation for the range of n, f, and n, c you gave us, those have a runaway potential. So,
but they interact with these things, so they get minimized fine when that happens.
That comes from the supergravity effect?
Yeah. It works. They get minimized at this value for that condensate, where it depends on depends on the ranks of the condensing range groups and on those coefficients at the value where you minimize them. And for a given set of the microscopic parameters, the A's and the N's and so forth, all these are giving you a potential. This then phenomenologically, this square root tells you that Q minus P is greater than 2. You have to have a difference of at least 2. And for essentially all the examples I give you, I'll take that difference to be 3. We've calculated it for others, and you know, it's not interesting.
But you have to, there are compactifications where that's not.
If you want physical solutions, you need the square root to be positive.
Right.
And so, there are always solutions. What the philosophy in physics in general, as you know, and here, is we want to see if there are a set of solutions which can describe physics in a robust way. So we look for solutions which satisfy supergravity approximations so we can use that. We look for physical solutions. We want to see what we end up with. There could be no solutions, or there could be a robust set. There are lots of other solutions, and some of them could be physical too. We just don't know. So in particular, we can look at the minimum of the potential, and now I'm heading toward the part that's relevant for the multiverse. We can look at the minimum. We see that the condition to make it a de Sitter minimum, which is metastable, I'll show you the graph in a minute, is that this combination of things be negative. And in particular, it vanishes at the minimum if this P effective, we'll call it, P times the logarithm of these guys, has this numerical value. The 28 is 7 times 4. It's again depending on the 7 of the G2. And the Q minus P we're going to take to be 3. It had to be at least 2. And this is actually then a big number because of the numerator. We find, amazingly, that 30% of the entire parameter space that satisfies supergravity approximations has gravitational masses in the region below 100 TeV. And 100 TeV is TeV scale for reasons I'll show you in phenomenological terms. And then, if we actually use this condition to set the value of the potential at to zero at the minimum. In fact, all the solutions go away except those below 100 keV. We find no solutions that satisfy these general conditions that aren't physics in our region, starting only with the Planck scale as input. We'll see in a minute that also Gugino masses are suppressed over that entire parameter space, basically by the stringy factor. And this is very much like the volume of the three-cyclone approximately. So I emphasize physically that there are no fluxes in this, so we don't have 10 to the 15 GeV mass scales naturally with other stuff, and the supersymmetry is broken spontaneously, not explicitly.
There's always in these calculations a constant in the superpotential. There's usually, you can have a constant in the superpotential, independent of all the fields, okay?
You can add one.
Yeah, so yeah. So the question is, if you're working around a vacuum where the underlying manifold preserves an R symmetry, then that constant is zero and Gugino condensation generates spontaneously a non-zero constant. But are you doing that, or is this constant just a free parameter that you've set to zero?
For the M-theory case, I think we're at the stage where we're just taking it to be some, well, let me just a minute. Just a minute. Let me. So here's what the potential looks like, where you can't see, this is not at zero, this is actually at this value. And so we want to set this to zero and any other constants that are present too. Yeah. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but
no.
we don't have a
there. You did some calculation of the potential. Now, there is, in principle, another contribution to the potential that comes, you know, in supergravity if there's a constant in the superpotential. Now, if you don't have a symmetry in the vacuum state, you're working with an R symmetry, then what you would find, if you just did one loop corrections in 11-dimensional supergravity, even if the constant was zero classically, you would find it was non-zero quantum mechanically. And that, my question is whether you have a symmetry that sets it equal to zero or not.
No, I don't think we do. But once we've gone to four dimensions, we don't see that happening, but we don't have the R symmetry present.
Well,
and we don't have a symmetry that does it. The Gugino condensates don't generate it. So I haven't thought much about that.
Gugino condensates do break all R symmetries.
Yeah, I think they actually do.
Do.
I think that's all that's happening, right?
That's fine.
Yeah.
The question is, if before the Gugino condensate you had an R symmetry, so that any microscopic high scale contribution to W naught is just zero by symmetry.
Yeah.
You think the answer to that is zero?
I think it's okay. But I actually am not sure, so it's a good question you come back to. So let me go back a couple slides just to give you a feeling for the numerical values of these things, the rank of the gauge group, that's the dual Coxeter number actually, for different groups. This gives you a feeling for what that p is that's in front of the logarithm. So now comes the point that's most relevant for, say, multiverse issues. In order to get the p times the logarithm to be the value that I calculated on that slide, 84 approximately, we need the logarithm itself to be a number sort of in the range of 3 to 8. So the argument of the logarithm has to be large. That depends on the threshold corrections to A1 and A2 at the string scale. Those are not trivial to compute. So the computation was done for one example by Friedman and Witten in 2002. They showed that mathematically that computation that might look like a calculation of a threshold correction in a conventional way from Kaluza-Klein states could be converted into calculating the torsion for a lens space. And they did this calculation. So here's one example of how a number can look, can make us uncomfortable and improbable. So it's an SU3 space divided with a discrete symmetry Z sub Q. where Q is typically naively would think it makes sense to have Q be 2 or 3 or even 5 for a divisor of this space. It turns out that in order to make this work in the one example Friedman-Witten did, we need Q large, over 100. So that's an example of how that makes me very uncomfortable. We can do it. It's technically possible to do it. But you would never expect it to come up in a simple case, and we have no reason why it should come there. But what most people who look in detail with us at it say is that if we would go to other lens spaces, then we would find we could do it with a reasonable value of Q. And just very recently, Malcolm Perry got interested in the computation, and he's now, last week, he completed the calculation for several lens spaces, and now one has to work out what actually the argument is in those, and that, you know, I was hoping I'd get an email today with the answers, but probably next week or the week after, we'll know if we actually have a reasonable G2 manifold in which we can make sense of what we need to set the cosmological constant to be small enough in this case. But you see, it's a very, it's a tuning issue, and it's an important one. And if you can't tune it small enough, suppose the A1s and A2s only took on either values for which we couldn't satisfy the equation I wrote, that P effective was equal to 84, or that you couldn't make fine enough adjustments, then this theory would not really be meaningful, even though it's looking good phenomenologically. So let me go on a bit. So given this theory, you can then go ahead and compute with standard techniques the Gravitino mass. I'll just show you stuff later, but you get expressions. Here's the meson condensate. Here's the graph of the potential I showed you. It's a metastable. Where'd it go? It's a metastable minimum, but the lifetime to tunnel out of that is known to be long compared to the lifetime of the universe. That's okay. But the cosmological constant, which is the value of the potential at the minimum physically, is not zero. It's not small. It's 10 to the 11 GeV or so. So can we do meaningful phenomenology? So we set it to zero in the way that I showed you. We actually then check that the difference between superpartner masses and the dark matter properties and all that stuff is changed small amounts, a few percent at most, by doing that tuning. So it doesn't change any of the other phenomenology you would get. There is this point that I made once that I want to emphasize. Setting the cosmological constant to zero at the tree levels does imply that some relation between the small cosmological constant and the TeV scale. In most approaches, you have to do both separately. Here we are able to do one. Let me turn to the Gugino masses, the superpartners of W's and Z's and photons and Higgs's. There we have a grand unified theory, so they're universal at the string scale, and you can compute them. And the key thing is they have one over that large factor in them that comes out of just the basically the string theory and supergravity calculation. And this factor is a stringy factor. It's not a phenomenological factor.
Your compactification has not picked out the unification group. So you say assume,
no,
but it might have been SO14 or...
There's dozens of groups which, because you have several things and they're coming in this particular ratio, say, and with other stuff, we can't pick out a unique answer. Maybe if we had enough data, but I don't think so. I think what this is typical of what's going to come out of string theories and of these predictions, that you will find certain combinations of parameters that are stringy, but that show up in the measurable observables. So there'll be plenty of string theory things that show up, and there are constraints on them and so forth, but they're not going to be uniquely determined without a lot more information. So what that factor shows you is that if we just had no other contribution to the Gugino masses, they would be suppressed by about a factor of 40 from M3 halves. But there are other contributions. So this is a little technical for people, but it matters a little bit. I just have two slides to mention it for people who are more knowledgeable. There are anomaly mediation contributions, and because of this large suppression, they actually are important, and you get cancellations. And when you look, so in order to check that detailed gauge coupling unification works quantitatively, we have to combine these. Here's zero, and so what you see is that in the region where you do get detailed gauge coupling unification, that M2, which is the Wiedel mass, is the smallest number. So we predict, by putting in that we want gauge coupling unification, we predict that the dark matter is Wiedel-like in this theory.
So how could you not get gauge? I mean, this is a unified theory. No. Going back to M theory, it's only one dimension.
You always have qualitative gauge coupling unification, but we want to be able to start from these numbers and run down and get the experimental numbers exactly.
No. So my question is, okay, are there, within this large class of theories you're working in, okay, is in every one, is there, if you go to the string scale, a single gauge group for the annuals?
No.
So there might be a sum of the algebras. You might have.
We put in Witten's work, which assumes a unique one, but it doesn't tell you exactly what scale it assumes. So if you change the scale a little bit, then the gauge.
The key word is assumes. Within this class of theories, there are G2 compactifications in which you look at the string scale and you look at the Yang-Mills couplings, and there's 47 different factors in the Yang-Mills gauge group, SU2, SU19, SU6, etc. There are such cases.
As I said at the beginning, but you already here. I said that we're using the work of Witten and collaborators to embed the matter. So we've taken his SU5 embedding as a local embedding in the G2. That's not a derived global embedding in the G2 manifold. When you make a derived global embedding, you will get one or several choices of unified theories, which you can then look at the consequences of having. So we're using his SU5 embedding to do all these calculations. That's an assumed SU5. Then the question of exactly what scale you're at is depending around the high scale. There's an order of magnitude or so.
So string theory or M theory does not predict gauge coupling unification at the unification scale. If that's not seen for some reason, that's okay too.
No. No one has yet understood the mathematics of the G2 manifold well enough to do what you've done in some Calabi-Yau spaces and written down a definite predicted embedding. So Witten showed that it accommodated a particular embedding of SU5, which is what we used. We took his work and showed that it was accommodated correctly as a local embedding. But there isn't yet a unique prediction or a prediction of a set of things to test for G2. But to say that it does not do it is incorrect.
What happens to proton decay?
Witten in particular was interested in proton decay. He showed that embedding was consistent with proton decay and double triplet splitting and all those kinds of arguments. And we're just, as I said, we're just using his work there. We haven't yet got a better embedding that we're taking over.
So the issue here is that in the standard vanilla MSSM calculation, we can choose the SUSY particle masses in a rough random way, and we get some unification. And here you're predicting more precisely what they are, and you're telling us what you have to do in order to get unification to really work with the
quantitative, correct, within errors. And
this is this is one loop or two loops?
Two loops.
Two.
And the key point I'm making here is that it then tells us what the dark matter mass and approximate mass, but in particular quantum numbers, has to be. The dark matter has to be Wiedel-like, could be, you can mix in a little bit of something else, depending on where you are, but it's basically a Wiedel particle. It's predicted to be the dark matter. That's fun phenomenologically because the recent observation of the Vanilla satellite experiment with a positron excess in the galaxy is precisely what you expect from just this Wiedel dark matter. so it's much too early to be more than amused by it. But if there, if this were the correct dark matter, the Pamela experiment would have reported what it did.
What about the Dan experiment? Is it also where Dan is
The Dan experiment can be interpreted right now in a consistent way, not inconsistent with any other dark matter experiments, in two ways. One is with very light superpartners, which is not the case here. And that window is almost closed, but maybe not completely. And second, with heavy particles, it definitely allows a Wino of this mass, of the mass we will get. But whether it satisfies all the constraints numerically for this one to interpret, to give you an explanation of both Pamela and Dama, we haven't, we're in the process of checking constraints, like when they gather at the center of the sun, would you get too many neutrinos that would have been seen in Super K, for example. We haven't finished doing that. So, but it's at least close to agreeing. It'd be fun. To get the heavy interpretation, the Gaginos have to be Dirac instead of Majorana ones. And you have to have actually an R symmetry that protects the Gagino masses. 200 GeV is allowed, but you have to have that. Then when you break the R symmetry, you need a small splitting like 100 KV. So there's a big set of constraints that are need checking to make sense of this, and it's sort of fun to play with that, and that's work underway. So if you don't hear any more about it, it didn't work. The point I'm making here is that, and there's the constant crossed out. The point I'm making here is that the scalar masses are M3 halves times a 1. So they're heavy like M3 halves, and they'll be in that tens of TeV region. And the Gagino masses are suppressed by that factor of about 40 from that. Here's the superpartner mass spectrum. So they're not calculated totally accurately. For example, here's the Galeno mass. It varies by a factor of 2 or so, the allowed Galeno masses. These are ranked. That is, if the LSP is here, then these two are at the same mark and have to be heavier than that. But they're, the masses are not badly predicted from first principles. Here's the Higgs mass. The scalars are all heavy by RGE running from 50 or 75 TeV. The partner of the top quark runs harder and gets a low mass. This dashed line is more or less the LHC sensitivity. So the LHC will see these guys and the Higgs and conceivably this after a long time, but probably only these guys. But it can see, it'll produce this in October if it works as advertised. And whether it's, I'll show you in a second, signature, which is fun to see it. So this is the spectrum.
What happens if you don't see them? What happens if you don't see this?
Then this is wrong.
So I mean, because the problem with modern phenomenology has been if you don't see something, you push things up.
Oh, this model, you cannot push it up. This is wrong.
This is good physics.
So this is
either right or wrong.
This is right or wrong.
So
but
what's the range for your Higgs mass correction?
The Higgs mass is about 125 to 145 or something like that. It doesn't show well on the graph, so I'm just remembering.
So you're giving up on Petri paradoxes. You're giving up on Petri paradoxes.
Oh, yeah, that won't work here naively anyhow because of the heavy other masses. But we definitely have a good leptogenesis. The cosmology is different here from the usual radiation-dominated one because the moduli dominate right after inflation. So all the things you're used to that are not coming from concrete calculations change. But we have at least one and probably two variogenesis approaches that work.
And so that Higgs is going to be pretty hard to see for that mass range. Well, relatively speaking.
It's a little easier than the lighter one at LHC. At LHC, it just gets worse and worse as you get lighter.
Absolutely.
And fairly, this isn't
so you can see the superpartners first, and then the Higgs.
Oh, yeah. The Higgs is hard to see because it's always in a background.
Absolutely.
whereas, and you must get statistics to just let it dominate. But the super partners are relatively easy. In fact, if our favorite thing works, so the cross-section for these galenos is a few in picobarns, and because of the RGE running, those of you who know about it, the lightest stop gets fairly light, as I showed you on that graph, and it's mainly right-handed. So actually the dominant decay of the galeno is to the top and a stop, and then the stop decays to top and the second neutralino. So you get two tops in the event from each galeno, so you get four tops. That's a signature which happens to be very straightforward and easy. So five events like this in October, they would recognize it and they have a discovery. It's an example of how sometimes you get nice, lucky signatures. And we don't want to take time to look at the rest of the details about that stuff. So let's turn back now to some of the multiverse issues. So assume that we can do the tuning somehow to make all this make sense. Then the naive argument is that you need 10 to the 90 vacua that all have standard model physics. People say 10 to the 120 all the time, but that doesn't include supersymmetry. So if you have a supersymmetric theory, you should only say 10 to the 90. Then it's tricky, because if I only don't want to affect the LHC predictions, which is what that Staley potential was giving me, then I really don't care about 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, but 10 GeV effects are fine. So 10 to the 40 is actually the correct number. That's a lot smaller than 10 to the 90, but still pretty big. Maybe many of the other ones are excluded by Weinberg's entropic argument and Banks's entropic argument. Sorry, Tom, but you need to know a measure to say that. In principle, we will calculate that measure when we understand these length space arguments and such things. And so we can actually work out some of this stuff after a while if we get to understanding this fully. But we do need some kind of multiple set of vacua that all have the same standard model and gauge groups and super partners and dark matter and everything else that we're doing if we're going to make sense of this. It doesn't make any sense otherwise to talk about that. And exactly how many is depends on how this kind of thing plays out. Having that small cosmological constant, remember, led to that suppression factor being determined numerically. So the Gugino mass prediction for that and the result that it was a Weino dark matter instead of something else depended on making the cosmological constant small. There's a real connection of this stuff now. And you can only make the cosmological constant small if your theory accommodates that in terms of the number of states you could have and if you can do that tuning. Whether the cosmological constant, with the value of the dark energy, 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, seems not to matter here. I can't find any way in which that itself is an important consideration, but making it very small is. Now, let me just take a minute to talk about supersymmetry in this context, because it affects some of understanding some of these predictions. We assume there would be some LHC signal for making this worthwhile doing. So back to this list of things, I just put in red the ones which come out of having supersymmetry be what is found. And then there are additional phenomenological ones, like the if you look at Lepp and Tevatron data, they require a like Higgs boson, and the fact that there were no effects at Lepp from beyond the standard model physics when it ran for 10 years points to a theory like supersymmetry. So there's a large motivation for that being what's found more generally. How should we think of this? We calculate a few things in this vacuum, then we predict other things and test them as they're mentioned later, and we get to understand the things on our list. What about the cosmological constant? We're not calculating it. Remember, we're tuning it in this case completely. So I want to spend a few minutes on one argument which might well be wrong, but I don't think is completely stupid, which says that there might be ways to calculate cosmological constants besides the anthropic argument. And the argument I'll describe is mostly, it's a little better than hand waving at this stage, but not too much. But it could give a small positive non-anthropic cosmological constant. And I always do things bottom up and not from the first principles. So phenomenologically, the thing that interested me most is to see whether we could get satisfactory inflation in this approach. And it does give inflation without any scalar field inflatons. And it doesn't have some of the problems of the usual inflation. So that adds to its attractiveness for me. There are a lot of assumptions. It's not a top-down approach. So my attitude is first assume it works, see what happens, and then work on making the assumptions work. So this is based on three papers. Malcolm Perry and I and collaborators have been working on this for some time. The third paper is the one on inflation. So a quick overview. As the idea is that as inflation begins, the universe is starting out at the moment inflation begins in an approximate De Sitter space, and then vacuum do mix. Tunneling, Hawking-Moss tunneling is allowed. It's never an exact De Sitter space because there's radiation right away from gravity waves and other things. And that'll set the initial, you set the initial condition, sorry. But you don't have ever a real De Sitter space after the first Planck time. Imagine that you can have a general superposition in a Blasi string vacua in our G2 theory or some other one. And all of those have standard model gauge groups and chiral fermions and such things. And then imagine an analogy with Bloch's theorem for a crystal where you get a band structure. Then you fluctuate up to the high energy density levels and it relaxes down to the ground state. And naively, on a simple calculation, suggests that you get down to an energy density of order the initial high level, like 10 to the 90, divided by the number of cases. Or if you really want the cartoon, think of level repulsion. If you mix two levels in quantum mechanics, they split. And if you mix three, they split more. And if you mix 10, the lower one goes down more. And you can keep doing that. While you're in the top level for a few Planck times or one, the scale factor does grow. In the next lower level, you're there for a few Planck times or one before it relaxes, and the scale factor grows, but less since this is smaller. And so inflation actually ends in the sense that it continues forever, but the amount of inflation is negligible after 100 or so levels, and you can get 50 or 75 or 100 E-foldings, depending on details, quite nicely from this sort of thing. We checked in the inflation paper that you also can get a reasonable power spectrum and other such things. In an ABS space, you can't have a connection between that and tunneling between vacua because of the infinite volume or Minkowski space. So this turns off as soon as you go below the De Sitter level. We of course, cannot calculate whether the lowest level is, so there's no way in which we can claim that we account for the dark energy value. This approach could account for having a small cosmological constant by saying that you can't do it in any one vacuum, but if you can superimpose enough, then there's a possibility that you would actually make sense of that. So it's saying that the right quantum theory calculation involves this entanglement or superposition. There's lots of decoherence from radiation and gravity, so the question is whether one can justify this. We have no good argument to justify it at this point. The inflation is quite different in interesting ways. There's no scalars that are causing inflation. There is no inflaton at all. Our inflation is hot, not cold, which the normal inflation is. It ends naturally. There's no reheating because you're at a hot level right to start with. And all of those kinds of things are reasonable, and in fact, they even help get moduli trapped in the right potential.
What sets the number of E-foldings?
You make a model of the amount of time in each level. You know the approximate energy density in those levels. And then you work it out, and you find that you get tens of E-foldings naturally. But it could be, we can't do better than, say, tens. You can get 30.
Field space between vacuum. Distance and field space between vacuum. The amount of time you spend has got to be how long.
You could either, you could, if you're really naive, just say that you have all these block levels and you're making transitions down as it relaxes. And assume you spend a few Planck times in each level and you know the energy density of each level, and then just do some arithmetic and you get tens. And any model you make is consistent with that. So it's no better than that. It's just saying that sort of the dimensional analysis makes sense with those numbers, so the e-folders. If the picture makes sense, then that's a reasonable thing. It's not a derivation or anything more complicated. One of the few things that is sort of quantitatively checked, the decay widths of the levels will be described by some parameter gamma. If gamma is too small, you'll just stay in the top level, and it won't turn off. If it's too large, you won't get enough inflation. It affects the scale invariant spectrum. And you can find that with one value of gamma, all this stuff is OK. So it's sort of consistent.
Maybe you've said sorry, but what generates the scale invariant perturbations?
You will automatically get scalar perturbations. We don't have scalars, so you can't use the normal calculation. So that actually held us up a long time. And finally, Scott Watson wrote down a two fluid calculation formally, where you can define all the numbers and do it. So half our paper is about sort of semi-meaningful calculation of those to show that it makes sense. Yeah, but it's not simple or straightforward. Physically, it's just that the scale is natural. You're starting at a high scale. So and inflation is ending around 10 to the 14 or 15 GeV. And so you're at a scale where the right density perturbations can make sense. But he did a final, Scott painfully got something to work that made sense without a scalar field. So see what you think. But it's described there. So let me, this is a little.
So isn't this similar to thermal inflation? Thermal inflation. So there is I don't know this very well, but there's a scenario that it's not just the scalar field, but a scalar field coupled to, I guess, the second scalar field.
We don't have any scalar.
That's right, but I wonder if your scenario is effectively the same as that, because. Inflation.
Our inflation is hot, not cold.
That's thermal inflation isn't cold.
Oh, the thermal inflation, though, hot. That normally occurs at the end, at much lower temperatures, the thermal inflation at the after. It's not usually the initial inflation. It's a final one for a few e-foldings to make some corrections or something. But so it's normally done at very low scales in the papers that it worked on. So it's not the same, and I haven't even tried to think if there could be something in common. Mm-hmm. But they do have scalars for theirs, so I would have to.
Well, I think very different people use the same terminology for thermal inflation. But in principle, you can have two scalar fields or a scalar field and something else like radiation. And it's part of the energy of a scalar field goes into radiation rather than.
Okay, I should look at that. I don't know.
You're not claiming that the CMB is generated by thermal radiation rather than quantum fluctuations.
No, quantum fluctuations, yeah. But and they're for example, you can have fluctuations in the levels, and you take account of that, and the whole thing can be fit together to give you that stuff. But the physical mechanism for that is it's still coming from inflation, yeah. Okay, so just another couple minutes on this stuff. Back to a simple hand-waving argument, well, a little better than the hand-waving for. This is now just a pure quantum, non-relativistic quantum approach. If you assume a potential like this and you try block trial wave functions, you do standard stuff from condensed matter physics books, then you do get a block spectrum like this and a level splitting that goes like 1 over n. And so you can imagine cascading down there. We did generalize it to the, for our case, we generalized it to the field theory case. And the minima are not then points in physical space, but they're different Calabi-Yau spaces or something like that that you go to. And you have to use instantons for the tunneling mechanism. They're not a space-time tunneling. And the calculations we do are using the Hawking-Wasson spintronics. And we generalize it to field theory and let a more complicated framework occur, and we can get a similar looking result like that. So it's at least, again, it's not, certainly not, I don't think it's stupid. You may not be right. The big problem is, can you make a superposition that makes sense, and can you survive the decoherence? So I don't know. I mean, it's obvious that that's difficult. Those degeneracies are present. But I don't know enough about how to calculate this. So if we can't make progress on this, we'll never know if this is valid. The early superposition and enough late coherence are what matters. The only progress in the last couple years on this, a year and a half, has been a very recent paper of Venus and Thomas, where they made a semi-classical construction of solvable construction of potentials. They find explicitly two degenerate vacua, which they find can be superimposed, and then you get one going up and one going down in a calculable potential that they, where they found the full solutions in multiple flat directions and are able to handle this. And Dean has told me last week that they've now generalized it to a large number superimposed, and they're looking at what happens in terms of the block wave function and whether they can make sense of this or whether they don't get a result like this or like that. So a few final comments then. Calculating in a given string back, doing phenomenology with string theory, really starting with 10 or 11 dimensional string theory, constructing the vacuum, seems to require, to make real conceptual sense of it, a large number of vacua that have the same low scale effective theory, which has got something to do with multiverse ideas. I'm not sure exactly what, but it does. And I don't know how to estimate the number, but if we need 10 to the 40 or 10 to the 90 that have the standard model gauge group and the standard model particles and are supersymmetric and do all that stuff, that's going to be, of course, a tiny part of the total number of vacua that, that you better have, because you're going to have lots of vacua that aren't like this. So estimates like the infamous 10 to the 500 are quite reasonable in that sense. We only need less than 1 in 10 to the 400 of that to make sense of this approach and get quite detailed. String theory is completely testable in our string vacuum. It has many predictions. It's testable in the same sense that F equals ma or Schrodinger equation is. You have to put in a force to test this. You can't test this generically. It only has meaning if you put in a concrete force. And similarly, we compactify and break supersymmetry. And then we have many testable predictions of string theory for each compactification and supersymmetry breaking that you do. And that's the sense in which you definitely can test string theory. Whether string theory has testable predictions like the field theory does, for example, that all electrons are identical because they're quantum in a given field, that I have no opinion about at this stage. I don't. Depends. Some people would say gravity is such a prediction and so forth. But regardless of that, string theory is as testable as F equals ma is. The multiverse aspect then of making sense of the vacuum has strong implications for LHC, for dark matter, for lots of other things. And if someone takes, if someone does type two string theories and puts in fluxes and stabilizes moduli, they will get definite different predictions, and they will have to have a multiverse structure in an appropriate sense. The way I want to use the word reductionist to conclude finds this all to be strongly reductionist, just like good old physics, but having a multiverse structure, string theory does provide a meaningful ground state. Meaningful implies that you can really make sense of the fact that you need this large number of vacua. And then all the things that we can see, from espresso to dinosaurs and stars and stuff, emerge. There aren't any mysteries in the sense that, we've got the whole structure. We can back up and calculate everything if we were a little smarter or had more money for postdocs or something. The forces and the particles emerge from a large number of dimensions, and then all the rest of the stuff comes out. But you can't do it, as far as I can see, without some multiverse structure. So I've led Republicans totally from this part of the world.
What about Republicans?
Oh, maybe we can find a vacuum without any.
They fund us.
Thank you.
We have to deconstruct them. We have to deconstruct them.
Yeah.
Don't.
Completely.
Gordon, a couple of phenomenological questions about the slides you flashed through quickly. So first of all, you have these very heavy squares. I guess that means that you can't solve what you call the small mz problem.
Correct.
Right. So, but this model would give a prediction for mz and it would be wrong.
If the Z-mass hadn't been measured, we would have predicted it to be a QTEV.
Right.
And I think maybe they measured it wrong, I'm not sure.
Okay, the second thing, it looked like you had a phase in the Gugino masses, so you have CP violation in uncomfortable places.
No, that's actually very interesting, and I didn't cover it. We've now actually computed all of the weak phases, and I don't understand why yet. It looks remarkable, but we can actually rotate away all the weak phases in this theory. There is no weak phase here.
Does that mean you've also solved the strong CP problem?
No, that's a different question. Here, to solve that, we have to have some of the axions that survive down to the QCD scale.
Oh.
As you know. And there seems to be some, and we're checking now whether that's stable in the radiative corrections. But it looks like we have no weak phase, and like we can solve the strong CP problem in exactly this framework, but we have we're doing all these different calculations at once.
Final question. The standard problem in these kinds of gravity-mediated theories with Clebier-changing neutral currents comes about because there are dimension six, I guess, operators in the Kähler potential that are a product of two hidden sector fields that get F-terms and two spark fields. And then when you put in those large F terms of hidden sector fields, those give rise to spark masses, which are non-universal and so on. What happened to that term in this problem? Why isn't it there?
If those terms are not as big as the diagonal terms, then given that our scalars are heavy, we're completely safe. And given that they're heavy, we're almost always completely safe. We have not finished checking. Remember, the scalars are all heavy. The third family ones are getting a little lighter, but that doesn't really matter for that question.
So they're mostly up above 10 T.
Yeah, all.
Okay, so this is connected to the fact that you predicted CMAS.
Right. So, yeah, it's probably no problem. We assumed initially the Kähler potential was approximately diagonal, and then it's clear there's no issue.
Sure.
And eventually we'll get around to checking exactly what that is. Need more students in postdoc.
Okay, I want to understand precisely what you mean by these planes. So let me say some things and see if you agree. Okay. What is being tested, you display some predictions for a few super partner states. What is being tested is there are two ways to talk about what's being tested. I want to see if you agree with both of them. One of them is you start with string theory or M theories. You pick a particular kind of compactification. You make a list of other assumptions, which you describe to us. Okay? And then you tune the vacuum energy. And then you get a light gravitino. And then a number of these things follow. Okay? So given that list of assumptions, these are predictions. Okay? If they're not seen, then something in this package, and we were talking about packages earlier today, is not right. And presumably, it's not directly string theory. That is, NEMA would be very happy, for example, to say split supersymmetry and we see no superpartners at the LHC, and still string theory is the correct description at a higher scale. So It's the package of string theory plus a particular compactification plus a list of assumptions that are being tested. Okay. Now, from another point of view, okay, where you arrive at is somewhere, correct me if I'm wrong, because you're much more you're an expert on these things and I'm not, but it's somewhere within the parameter space of a minimal supersymmetric standard model.
Oh, no, that's, in this case, as I said, we use Witten's embedding of that, the SU5 minimal case. But there are people right now writing down embeddings that where the pH group is E6 and lots of other things. So it's, and that has extra, that's an extended minimal case. You always include the minimal case because the minimal case is just the standard model mates.
No, what I want
but it's an extended.
What I want to understand is if you agree, okay, somewhere in the parameter space of the minimal supersymmetric standard model is some extension of it, okay, is a region of that parameter space where the predictions that you describe also obtain. So if somebody writes, if what you see, you know, if these states are seen on the nose and no other states, and somebody writes a paper and says, we have confirmed the usefulness of the minimal supersymmetric standard model, and we have located where in the parameter space we are, with no reference to string theory, the cosmological constant, right, quantum gravity, supergravity, you would be happy.
Well, I would then, they simply didn't recognize where it came from. That's the way we've done physics for 400 years. The standard model itself has three times as many parameters as an effective theory as MSSM does, and people could have seen all the standard model stuff and not recognized it was a 3-2-1 gauge group.
But now
and that's the same question.
Okay, so now you're making, so now we're there, and I'm this conservative supersymmetric standard model physicist, and you're making the claim you're making. And you want to convince me that what's been observed is
right,
more than just supersymmetric standard model physics.
Easy to do. I can make a whole host of additional predictions that that person can't make.
Good. Okay. So, and these further narrow you down within the parameter space of the minimal supersymmetric standard model, or?
Well, they'll involve baryogenesis and dark matter and lots of other stuff. It, probably inflation, although we haven't finished that work yet. There's a small number of parameters in a sense, and they affect all these other things. And so we'll be able, given time, all the CP violation physics. And the person who does it in the minimal case won't have CP phases that they can get their hands
so you'll
on.
Be able to
we'll predict electric dipole moments.
Okay. So you'll be able to say, here's a list of experiments which are not expected on the basis of the minimal supersymmetric standard model, and which, if they're seen, will be evidence of Planck scale or string scale physics directly.
As much as it's possible to say that in any case, even in the standard model again, nobody has explicitly seen SU3 written on the sky. You're looking at predictions. And so you say these predictions come from that, and that's how you test it. You really know that, right?
Yeah, sure, but I mean, we haven't seen SU3 written on the sky, but we have a long list
of correct predictions
with hadrons.
So at a certain point, everybody just says it's this, and that's it. That's how physics has always worked. When a certain number of the right physicists say it's done, then it's done.
And then you wait a generation to make sure. But okay.
Okay.
Anyway, that's a conversation
sure.
over one. I just want to understand precisely the assertion.
Right. It'll be the same as the other things. The
difference that's not the same with the other things is that there are string theorists or people working with string theory who claim that you should see that on their favorite way that lower energy physics emerges, you should see no superparties. And there still is a wide divergence of scales that we're probing at the LHC1 scale, and we're going to learn a lot about that scale, and that's great, and we may see.
But they're making probabilistic arguments rather than concrete calculations. If you don't see anything, then you should go back and see what they said or reread it or something. But otherwise, don't worry.
Well, okay. At this point, it's a long conversation.
It's a different approach. Completely different. They're not compactifying. They're not doing anything that
Right, but when you make a claim theory X is testable, you do not include a particular approach to theory X is testable. Theory X is testable whether you take a good approach or a dumb approach. I mean, quantum mechanics is testable.
I claim it's exactly like F equals MA. It is not testable in general. You must put in a force to test F equals MA. The idea of testing that equation is not meaningful. And this is exactly the same. This can be tested in exactly the same sense as that. It's not exactly the same. That's not fair. Because here, one will describe the world. But each version can be tested.
F equals MA is a consequence of momentum conservation, which is a consequence of translation variance. And
if you're testing
it, sure. It's a very general, generic thing. It's not the same kind of.
Yeah, but you're saying you have an underlying theory which implies F equals MA. That might be true here too. But if you want to say you're going to test it, you have to put in a force and do a calculation. And similarly here, you can do that in the string theory case. There may be other tests in string theory. I'm neutral on that. I'd be perfectly happy if there were. But that's a separate question.
Something puzzles me. You use play on words. You use the word multiverse, many universes. How can I picture the following, the string theory with 10 to the 40 radical states in our universe? And some genius comes along and finds a selection principle, equations, boundary conditions. That can select one or a few vacuum states in this universe, which then agree with SU3 plus SU2 plus SU1. Why multiverse?
I don't see any way in a given string vacuum how to get a cosmological constant that's consistent with small, regardless of the detailed number.
So you're
I can't imagine, and no one has ever seen this in a given string vacuum.
You're using the anthropic principle.
No, I am not.
But why do you have multiverses? Because of the cosmological principle.
Well, in our case, you can treat this anthropically if you like, but in our case, we'll have equations that don't have solutions. We'll have a large cosmological constant. It'll enter the scalar masses. It'll lead to false predictions. We won't get any of the stuff coming out that is relevant.
This is happening.
We can't make any possibly correct predictions for all
this. This is happening in our universe, so to speak.
To make it happen in our universe, you must be able to make the cosmological constant small in your theory. And you can't do that without that tuning.
Well,
we're led to that, I think, as far as I can tell, we're led to that completely generally.
One comment that, which I often make, that Camerlingonis discovered low temperature superconductors in 1911. It took 50 years almost to solve superconductors. Mm-hmm. We haven't strenuously been working 50 years on the cosmological constant part.
Close. Zeldovich first pointed it out just about 50 years ago.
But it's
been
critical since Weinberg's review article.
Well, it's been thought about close to 50 years. But and you're saying that just because we can't do it, we may find a way one day. But in these theories,
theory has to be changed something.
It's got to be changed at scales where you know it works, not up in some new region. Of course, I don't know if you can find a way someday, but I can't see any possible way of that happening that could make sense in these theories.
Well, in 1947, we couldn't see a way to solve the temperature superconductivity problem. We didn't introduce that.
Fine. I mean, you're welcome to take that point of view, and I'm basically saying that I don't see it, but okay. Given what we can understand so far, then this is where I'm led. But yeah, if you want that, that's fine. No problem.
Questions?
I missed the beginning of it. I had I'm
missing the part of the joke.
The mother's joke.
I introduced it by starting off saying, we live in a world where we can study physics at the TV school, but we'll never be able to study it at a higher school. Yeah. So, and practically, we have a chance of understanding Marx's reaction because Maxwell's equations give us TV energies, and we can afford them financially. And so, the technology and sociology make it possible. But that's it, we'll never be able to go any higher. Energies for understanding our vacuum. So that's how I introduced it. Because it costs tens of millions of dollars and technology doesn't allow it.
Okay, that's what you mean by anthropic. That's kind of an extension of what you mean.
That's what it's part of the joke.
Yeah.
But it's almost as anthropic as the other stuff.
Yeah.
Well,
so I guess we talked about this model of the superposition line before. I think. I was always interested in this. Going back to this, and it's very troubling, I guess. You are really, so on one hand, you want to get coffee or something?
Well, when I was beginning, you wanted to take this step to the home. Just sleep. Or going to maybe I'll just carry it.
You're back?
That's where I was thinking.
Yeah. Do you know what time they're leaving?
The bus is supposed to leave at 6:15.
Okay, so you have 45.
My borderline to go back.
So you're at Waterloo in
Maybe I should take it back, because otherwise I'll lose it. Even my record.
I can.